I get hopeless about it. And I think my, and we've talked about this, I think my hopelessness is actually a good thing. I actually think that for me as a white person to be hopeless about this in moments means I'm getting how bad it is. And I'll never get how bad it is, truthfully. I'll never get how bad racism is. Like, it's like almost been a reckoning for me to be like, oh my gosh, it is so deep and so layered that I feel hopeless about it. Actually makes me think like I'm starting to get it more.
Welcome to Deconstructing Therapy. Transforming therapy and the therapists who lead it. Let's deep dive into conversations, reshaping therapy into a powerful tool for healing, liberation, and systemic change. Join us as we challenge the status quo, reimagine care, and celebrate therapists breaking barriers. Let's transform therapy together. I'm so excited to have Christina James here today as my very first guest. Christina and I trained together in emotionally focused couples therapy, and I couldn't imagine a better person to kick things off with. Christina is based in New Orleans, and she is a licensed clinical social worker with over 20 years of clinical experience. Christina brings a compassionate and trauma-informed approach to her work with individuals and couples. Her practice integrates attachment theory, mindfulness, and the body-focused principles of sensory motor psychotherapy to help her clients uncover their inner wisdom. Beyond her work as a therapist, Christina is deeply passionate about anti-racism and justice. She infuses these values into her professional and personal life. I'm so honored to have Christina here today. Let's dive in. Hey, friend, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm so excited to be doing this with you.
I am too. I'm a little nervous, but also excited.
Yeah. So, I mean, the reason I wanted to really bring you on was I've always been really in awe of your passion and commitment to social justice and even anti-racism, or it's since the first time we've met, like in 2019. And even at that point, I wasn't as aware of issues as you were. So a lot of the stuff you used to say back then, like in externship when we first met, was like, hits me now. I'm like, oh, this is what she meant. This is why she was fighting so hard for that. And it was wonderful. It's really inspiring how passionate you are. So I'm just wondering, where did this start? How did that passion start in you? And what was your journey like? Where did you start learning about this?
Yeah, it's like, even as you're saying that, it's like, on the one hand, it's really nice to hear. And then on the other hand, I'm like, that's not how I view myself. I don't necessarily see myself as knowing a lot about this stuff. Like, I almost feel like I'm just at the beginning stages of understanding just racism in this country. So it's just like this interesting, like, kind of disconnect from like you describing me that way and the way I see myself. But I guess like when I was thinking about this before, I have thought about like, why is this something that interests me so much? And I don't like anti-racist work, social justice. And I think it's hard to like summarize that or to really understand it. But the first things that come to mind are that my dad is Quaker. He grew up Quaker, and Quakers have historically been, I don't know, not a lot of people know about Quakers, but Quakers have historically been involved in social justice. They were, many of them were abolitionists during slavery. Actually, one of my ancestors, so on my dad's side, worked with Harriet Tubman to facilitate the freedom of like 2,000 slaves. And then I think about my grandmother, my dad's mom, who was very active in civil rights and very outspoken. And I think that just hearing those stories growing up, I think it kind of sunk in. Like, that's one theory I have, is just hearing those stories about my grandmother and about Thomas Garrett, our ancestor, sunk in. And then going to a Quaker school where community and social justice was like just a mission statement with this school. I've also learned that even in Quaker communities, I mean, Quakers are predominantly white and historically have been predominantly white. Uh-huh. And their internalized racism also led them, and maybe continues to lead them, to make the same mistakes that all of us who are white and have internalized racism do. So anyway, that's a side note, like that even in conditions where you're, as a white person, I've been in very liberal environments and progressive environments, even then there's still so much learning to do and undoing of racism. And maybe even especially in some white liberal communities, there's a sense of like, well, like we're on the right side of things. Mm-hmm. And that we still have learning to do.
Not keep doing the work.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so back to my, how this became, you know, social justice, anti-racism, how I was influenced by that. I would say, yeah, my dad's side of the family was just Quaker. Then I went to social work school. Mm-hmm. And again, in social, going into social work school, still very naive and very unaware of my own internalized racism. There was one article they had us read. It's called, I think it was called White, like the Knapsack of White Privilege. And it was this article that a white woman had read or written in the 80s about all the things that as a white person, we don't have to think about in the US, you know, we don't have to worry that someone's going to follow us around a store when we're shopping. We don't have to worry that we're going to, if we walk into a meeting, that we're going to be the only person of our race. So then I went to social work school, which again is like known as being more liberal. And yet I felt really humbled even starting in social work school with how much I didn't know about my own internalized racism. And then my own like self-judgment of like, there were like the social work students who were seemed like super radical and like were just like very outspoken. And I was thinking like, oh, I'm not that. Like, I'm not radical enough. I'm not liberal enough, you know, and having some insecurities about that. And I still have those insecurities that I'm, you know, that I'm not as outspoken or as progressive or as radical as other white people doing this work.
That's so interesting. And like what you said earlier, like my view and your view seems so different. You're like, I'm just starting this journey myself. I'm noticing more and more about the internalized piece. But what got you started was, it is part of your history. It is part of your ancestry. It's like, it's kind of in your DNA to be part of social justice and hearing these stories, and kind of seems like your parents even embodied it, your grandparents embodied it. So this feeling of justice and social justice has been a cause for you that's deep. And later on in life, you kind of got confronted with some of these places where it hit this internalized racism or shame, is that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's almost, I guess, right. It's like, now that we're talking about it, it's like, I always knew racism was bad, or like, or maybe I didn't always know it was bad, but like I sensed it was a bad thing. Like that was the message I was getting growing up, is like, it's not good to be racist.
Right.
But it wasn't until I would say my 30s, 40s that it's like, oh, and I am also racist. Mm. Like it was almost, it's like level phase one was me like, it's like I see it in levels. It's like phase one was like, okay, I grew up in an environment where it was seen that racism was bad.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until there's this like deeper layer to it that I only started to learn in like, the 30s, 40s, that like I am part of that, like I have my own internalized racism, and that's been like,
that's like a journey in itself.
Yeah, it's like something that I can't unsee now, whereas there was a distance between with it before. It was like, I'm gonna work on like almost like not fixing racist people, but almost like,
okay,
like challenging racist views. But then it's another level to be like, oh, but I'm part of that. Like I've benefited from that. And I need to recognize that I have internalized racism, because that brings up a whole host of stuff, like a host of things. Like there's like shame around that. Mm-hmm. And there's like a wanting to reject that idea initially. Yeah.
Right.
And so I think that that's where, that's how it's evolved more in my 30s and 40s, where it's like, it actually, it's challenging, but it also feels really empowering too. Yeah.
I love the way you're kind of portraying this, because I see it in a lot of people, or people who are still in phase one of it.
Yeah.
You say, okay, I see that racism's bad, and I see the people who are overtly that way, and I'm very called to fight this and call people out. But there was something else that hit you of like, oh, wait, no, this is inside of me too. I have to really introspect and be humble. And that's a hard place. That's a hard place in general, right? When you have to realize some of your own shadow. But when it comes to racism and these bigger systemic things, I'm sure it's a lot bigger. So can you tell me a little bit about how that process unfolded? Do you know, like, when that shift happened of, oh, wait, this is, I'm racist too. This is a part of me here that I need to really look out in a humble way. Did you ever resist it too? Was there ever a period of time where you were?
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think one thing that just stands out to me, and I can't even remember how I came to this course, but there's an organization called White Awake, and their whole focus is doing courses with only white people. Side note, I used to think that was racist to just have a group for white people where you talk about racism. So that was its own thing for me, is like, wait a minute, only white people talking about racism, that sounds racist. Like, so.
Yeah. And a lot of people still, you know, that's hard for people to wrap their head around.
So yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit of why that isn't racist, why that is necessary?
I think what I've learned in terms of it being necessary is, first of all, the do no harm. I've had experiences in multiracial groups where, like, I'm grappling with something that I am ashamed of, that I've said or done that might be racist, or even just someone perceiving me as racist. And I'm like having a struggle about that. Like, I might cry about that, right? Like, I might cry about the fact that someone saw me as racist. And if I've had moments where I've done that in multiracial groups, and that could be causing harm to someone who's not white. That's a whole other topic. Like, not that in and of itself my crying is a bad thing, but it means a white woman crying about being told she's racist has like a whole different, I imagine, impact on, or could have. See, I'm even catching myself right now. I'm like, oh gosh, like I'm catching myself right now. Like, I don't want to make a generalization. I don't want to speak for people of color. But what I've heard is a white woman crying about being perceived as racist may not feel great to a person of color, you know, who's had to endure a bunch of shit. And so,
that's great. So I just want to pause for a second, because just you talking right now shows so much of how you've done this work and your humility with it. You're saying, I stepped into these situations of we have to all be together. I can learn from the people of color. We should be having these conversations together to, oh, wait, no, there's a difference. I can't be putting this emotional labor on people who've already had to carry too much.
Yeah.
And then also just such a quick awareness of, wait, I also want to be acknowledging that we have different experiences because a person of color and a white person, but then I also don't want to generalize. Like, like just how quickly you did those two things of, I have an awareness of how we're different, which is necessary, and also how I don't want to generalize. I think that is missed so often.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I do think being a therapist helps with that. I do think that, like, my training as a therapist helps me track what I'm noticing that I'm doing in the moment, and then being able to say that. Like, that's taken me years to be able to. It's like, oh yeah, you can just pause and say the thing you're feeling in the moment. Like, you can show your cards. But that, yeah, I would say my therapist training and sharing that with individuals I work with, of like, oh, I'm noticing this thing's coming up for me right now, I'm going to share that with you. Like, I couldn't do that years ago. So that is like one of the benefits of our training as a therapist.
I haven't seen all therapists do it well, especially when it comes to race. So it does take a different level. But yeah.
Well, and even like, I'm thinking about like the crying in a multiracial group. I'm sure there have been times where I have consciously or not wanted, if I'm like saying like, oh, I feel bad that I was been seen as racist or whatever. Mm-hmm. There probably has been a desire from me in a multiracial group for the people of color to tell me, no, you're not that. Like, no, you're okay. You're good. Right. Yes. And that is like, while that's a human need that I have, that is also causing harm, because I'm asking the very people that are going to be harmed by this to tell me I'm okay. Mm-hmm. And so that is where it's like, oh, don't do that. Like, or if you're going to talk about these things in a multiracial group, like, really need to be led by some very skilled facilitators.
Yeah.
Like we should not be leaving that work to people who are just kind of like, to facilitate a multiracial group and having these like deep layered hard conversations. Really, I strongly believe this, need to be led by highly experienced, highly talented facilitators. Cause that is not, you're going to end up doing more harm.
Yeah.
And we've all,
And I really, again, that's such an important point, because so many times as a person of color, we're deemed these experts just because of our skin color.
Yeah.
You teach this group, you do this. Oh, what do you, and that's causing harm. So I like really like that you're emphasizing, no, you need to have the skill set. You need to have the training. Simply having a lived experience doesn't mean you're an expert at facilitating such a group. And there's so many nuances to it. We don't want to be so isolated from people of color that we're not having these discussions together. But we want to be aware of, if somebody is in process, like, what harm can be done when you're in a mixed group like that as well. So
absolutely.
So many different things there. And you talk about, oh, hey, a place I can get stuck is, oh, I have this yearning, I have this desire for the person of color to take care of me or tell me I'm the good white person, you know, to save me from that. And what I love about you is you're always so humble and honest about, oh, yeah, there's a little bit of a feeling that I want that savior. I want to be absolved of this feeling of being a bad white person. And I think that's why you can grow so much, because of your humility. Can you talk a little bit about the places that people tend to get stuck? People in the dominant culture tend to, I know that's definitely one, right? Of, I don't want to be seen as the bad white person. So that's where I'm motivated by. What are some other places?
I think the one concept that comes up, I think, a lot, and it's connected, is defensiveness. Okay. Like, I think what I like to, white people can be so defensive. We can be so defensive. And when I talk about defensiveness, I actually think that defensiveness is quite normal. I think defensiveness, meaning for all of us, like, and I do talk about this in therapy with couples, is like, ultimately, if we just broke it down, because we're socially wired, we want to be seen as good. We want to be seen as good by other people. We can pretend we don't, but ultimately we want to be included. We want to belong. We want to be seen as good. And we especially want to be seen as good by people we care about and respect. And so when I, as a white person, have been, and I've spent a lot of time protecting myself from being seen as racist, I want to say that too. That's also part of my personality. Like, I'm going to be so good in quotation marks. Like, you're not going to be able to tell me that I'm racist, but guess what? I have internalized racism. So I have done things, said things that have negatively impacted people of color. So anyway, when someone says to, I guess I'll just speak from my experience, implies that I have done something racist or says something racist, I do think that that initial feeling of defensiveness of like, I am not that, is actually like primal and instinctive and normal. And in that way, I think if we can talk about it like that, I think that it makes it seem less of a negative. That said, when a white person gets defensive with a person of color, if they've said that we're racist, also if a woman tells a man that he is being sexist, similar thing, that initial feeling of like, I am not that, and I need to explain to you why I'm not that, it's like, you've lost the person. You've lost the person. Like then you're not a trusted person. If you can't acknowledge that there's defensiveness there, like if you can't acknowledge that, you've had a negative impact, then you've lost them. Like you're not a trusted person anymore. But I do think it takes a lot of practice for us not to react in a defensive way.
It's coming from a natural instinct. You want to be seen as good, but you want to be seen as who you are in the whole totality of that, and you want to connect. And so the defensiveness makes sense. We don't need to pile on more shame to that protective strategy. But yes, also, when that protective strategy comes up, you start disconnecting more. You disconnect from the person you're talking to, and you disconnect from being able to take some accountability and introspection and understanding.
Yeah.
So what do you do with it instead? Because it is big, right? Oh my God, I'm being called racist. I'm being called sexist. There's a very natural instinct to say, not feel like you're painted as just a horrible person. Yeah. So when that defensiveness comes up, how do you know it's coming up? And what do you do with it now instead?
I think when the stakes are lower, so when it's not about racism and when it's not about these like entrenched oppressive systems, if I'm like in a conversation with my sister, I might just say like, oh, well, first, I'm sure my first reaction is like just to say, no, you're wrong. I think that's like, that's my first reaction. It was like, no, you know, you don't understand. So like, that is my first shot is not good. I think with my sister, like, for example, with my sister, I might just say like, I'm noticing that I'm getting defensive. But I will say it's very different for me when the stakes are higher. And that is when I am, you know, when someone has said like, hey, that impact, when it's around racism or any other sort of ism, hey, that really impacted me. So what actually a very practical thing that I've worked on is I have a white affinity group that I work with. And again, these are words like white affinity group. I had no idea what that was like 5-6 years ago. All of this, like I want to use plain language too, because I had no idea what that was before. But essentially what I've learned is a white affinity group is, and other affinity groups are groups where you can process the things you're struggling with the group that is, how would you say that? Like in your own culture or whatever, so that you're not doing harm to the people that you're trying to like, you know, that you're struggling in conversations with. So I have a white affinity group, which means there's three other women and I, am I saying that right? Yeah. Four other women and I, and we meet monthly and they're all white. And we basically talk about things that we're struggling with. I mean, so often I'm actually not called out for the things that I might say that could impact someone negatively in a racial way. Like so some of what we talk about is just, I think I might've said something that could have caused someone harm. And then we talk about it and we're able to say, hey, I was so embarrassed about this. We might cry about it. Right. And then we get support from the others. So it's like, even me mentally knowing that I have this group where like, let's say I like mess up out in the world, I can come back to this group and they are going to be able to handle my white lady tears, you know, because they're also white and like they've had them too. Mm-hmm. And one practice, one of them is like very skilled with this stuff. So for a little while, one thing we did was we actually practiced like on a physical level, reacting to something that we've gotten defensive about. Let's say someone said like, hey, that sounds really narrow-minded, you know, and we bring that example in there and we actually feel like let ourselves like feel the shame that came up in that actual example. And then you look at one of the other women on the Zoom call and they're like trying to like give you a compassionate face, you know, kind of, and, wow. and kind of just almost like soothing you, comforting you so you can come down from it. And you do that enough times so that like you're not as activated by the end. And the idea is that like you're letting your body tolerate the feeling of defensiveness and knowing like, oh, I can get through this. So that when it happens in real life, you're more likely to be able to be like, okay, this is what does what I do to calm myself down. And also I have this group that I can talk to you about this in a couple of weeks where I can, if I'm brave enough, and sometimes I'm not brave enough, but I'm brave enough to tell them. Yeah.
That's great. So it sounds like the first part is just realizing how big defensiveness plays into it and not shaming yourself. Again, for even feeling that way, but understanding this is a natural thing that comes up. I want to be seen as good, but there's not a container for it in certain scenarios. So when it comes up, realize it, understand it in your body, be able to soothe it. And then having this white affinity group really gives it a helpful container as well. And so what does that end up looking like, say, in an interaction between you and a person of color? The defensiveness comes up, and when it doesn't take over, what are you able to do instead?
Well, so this came up. So I was in a training and it was a multiracial training facilitated by two very skilled facilitators. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of work and on not getting defensive. And I can't even remember the details, and the details might not even matter. But essentially, there was a question that we had to answer that said something like, what are the strengths? The question was, what are the strengths of you as the dominant culture? So I'm white, that's the dominant culture. What are the strengths you have? Now, I did not like the word strength. That's what I took umbrage with, was the word strength. Mm-hmm. If the word had been privilege, I would have been very able and free to answer that. But the word strength caught me up. And so I said, like, I'm having a hard time describing being in the dominant culture as having strengths. And some of the women of color in the group, to be fair, said, essentially took that to mean that I was saying I wasn't acknowledging that there's privilege of being white, right?
How did now, you hear the word strength and privilege as different?
Strength sounds like you did something to deserve it. Strength to me sounds like
I should be proud of this. This is.
It sounds like white nationalism. I don't know. It's like, it's like
popped into my head too. I was like, sounds like white power. Like, no, I don't have that yet. That makes
Whereas sense. Privilege, absolutely, I'll acknowledge that, but I don't. Strength sounds earned, and I didn't like that word.
That makes so much sense.
So these women in the call, they don't know me. They don't know I'm a good white person in quotation marks.
They don't know that. I promise.
You're like, I swear. And so they're like basically saying to me, like, don't deny that you have certain privileges. Mm-hmm. And ooh, like every cell in my body wanted to be like, no, you don't understand, right? Yeah. You don't. And honestly, this is why this stuff is so deep. And I just, it's so hard. It's so hard. Because if I had a relationship with them, they might have known my heart, right? Yeah. They might have known. But there's like, what I needed to do in that moment was be like, I represent something to them. I represent to them all the white people who don't acknowledge their privilege. So it's like, this stuff for me is like, okay, in theory, I know I won't get defensive, right? It's so easy when it's theoretical. Mm-hmm. But when I, who probably has some thoughts that I have done more work around this as a white person than other people, when I say something where the impact was that I wasn't acknowledging my privilege, I really wanted to like explain and talk back. You know, I couldn't see that like I'm a whole person. Like it was so hard for me not to
This sounds like a particularly difficult situation too, because it's, but again, I love the layers of humility that you have around this. You've done so much work, and if it's really touching on something that you might have done and not realized it, you're actually able to settle down your defensiveness and say, oh wait, what did I do wrong here? Yeah. In this scenario, it's like, no, I'm being misunderstood completely.
Yes.
They're seeing this word differently. So this is not a case of I have to introspect and I actually am doing something racially harmful that I'm not realizing.
Uh-huh.
It's like, no, this is just a misunderstanding. But you still have to humble yourself because yes. you have to say it still doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Right now, I'm a representation of something else for them.
Yes.
And I have to step into a pure place of humility. It's not about, you had to 100% silence. It's not about how I'm seen at all. That doesn't matter. The issue of how much harm they've had and how much that harm is connected to years and generations of pain. I need to just sit in that.
I just kept on saying to myself, suck it up. Part of it, part of me felt very bad doing that. I'm like, God, this is so to have to suck it up. But I just was like, I just suck it up, pull it in, you know, and knowing I have this white affinity group that I can go to later for it. Like I have this other group where I can process and they are going to understand me and they're going to understand my heart. But it was so humbling because I was like, I've been doing this work and I'm still struggling with this. Like,
So something like that. I'm picturing myself as the person of color in that room. And I think I've definitely even been in those situations where I'm triggered and then like a white person will just give me some flavor of that trigger and it gets very big and I can't.
Yeah.
See them for who they are. And if they were to do what you just did beautifully of just, okay, no, this is bigger than any of that. My ego needs to be silenced. It, like how I'm seen doesn't even matter in the face of such systemic harm. Like that's such great awareness. But is there room ever for connection there later on even?
That's what I was wondering. I mean, that's where I got caught up because I was like in an ideal world. Like, I think that's one of the things that white supremacy does is it divides us and it makes it so that none of us can be fully authentic with each other and have that be okay. Like, I don't know if that's true, but that's the sense I get is like, I couldn't be truly authentically myself in that moment and let them know because we don't have a relationship, nor can they be fully authentically themselves.
You keep saying it's because ever. You don't have a relationship. So if it was you and me having that,
yes,
you might be able to pause and say, okay, this is, you know, this big systemic wound has gotten activated. I need to humble myself and just be here for Alifia for whatever is coming up for her. I understand that. But then maybe later on, because we have a relationship, there could be space for, I think. Okay.
I think so.
It does make me uncomfortable to think that white people just always have to play humble and never say that they're always in the wrong and then never speak up, because that makes me feel uncomfortable too. Because I need to be checked. What if I'm saying something that's a misunderstanding that's not so always tricky. Racially charged or not coming from that painful place? It feels more uncomfortable.
I know. It's like, that's why in these moments I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is so big. This is so big and so layered and I get hopeless about it. And I think and we've talked about this, I think my hopelessness is actually a good thing. I actually think that for me as a white person to be hopeless about this in moments means I'm getting how bad it is. And I'll never get how bad it is, truthfully. I'll never get how bad racism is. Like, it's like almost been a reckoning for me to be like, oh my gosh, it is so deep and so layered that I feel hopeless about it. Actually makes me think like I'm starting to get it.
How big it is. Yeah.
And so, but yeah, I think like in that group, I did like one of my main questions was like, should we be doing that work in this multiracial group? Like I was trying to be vulnerable in that moment, right? Yeah. When I said, I have a hard time saying that this is a strength, that, you know, the white people have strengths, like just because they're white. And then that, I don't know if it felt like it was like safe enough with the relationships for us to work that out, you know? Yeah. I felt the same thing kind of like,
Is this so big? Is the wound so big that there can't be a certain level of connection? I think we're both saying we don't really know. This is something that feels so confusing. It's reminding me, you know, we're both couples therapists, of sometimes the attachment injuries, wounds in a couple are just so big that it keeps getting reactivated. And there's not a level of, sometimes it can be healed. Sometimes you can do this attachment. There's a betrayal, there's an affair. And sometimes you can do that work where you're able to both have space for each other. And one person's humble enough where they apologize, they take accountability, and then you can kind of move past it. And sometimes it's like, this person has done injury over injury over injury over. And the betrayed person, their nervous system just, it's too big.
Yeah, right. That it's like, do you work on it then? Like, do you work on it? Is that,
because our goal is like to have that mutual understanding or a space, right, of inclusion, but we don't want to do that at the cost of not recognizing how big these things are.
Yeah. And you could say that, like, that moment for me, where I really feel like I made the best call in that moment, not to be defensive, but also not to be authentic. That's another privilege that white people have, is to be authentic. I mean that in, like, there's a certain freedom I have to just say things and, you know, have it be okay because I'm white, among other white people, at least. What am I trying to say? Okay. Is it like that moment in that group I was in where I sucked it up, wasn't defensive, but also wasn't authentic? We could say, like, well, then what do you do? Like, how are we going to make progress here?
Yes.
But the reality is, I do think that's still progress, because now I'm talking to you about it. If you can hang in there, as a white person, like it's grist for the mill, and that it's so humbling, is like this is lifelong work to understand this, because there's so many nuances, and we will all continue to experience, like, we're in this racist culture.
Yeah.
And so there's always going to be work to be done, but there's a loss there that I and the women of color couldn't have, like, a real conversation about that. And it's also a learning opportunity. Like, it's an opportunity, because I did go back to my group and I talked to them about it. And one thing that they said is, like, you're feeling like you got pinned as something because of your race.
Yes.
Like, they're like, what do you think people of color are doing every single day? And so for them,
why are you closer to that feeling?
And then I felt deep shame about that. Then I started crying in the group, and I'm like, oh my God, that's so embarrassing. I didn't even see that. And they're like, no, this is what we're here for. But you could see how that, like, I needed to be with other white people to talk about that.
Yes.
So, yeah.
This is a great example, because it's really showing how complicated this is. And if you keep your goal really small, like, if your goal is like, I just want to be seen as a good white person, I just want to be seen, you're missing the boat.
Right.
And then again, when it shifted to, okay, no, our goal is to connect with each other, even then you can miss how big this was. When it's this big, and you can really sit in the humility of, this is really big. This is, I just became a local representative of huge generational trauma. And if I can sit with that humility and also sit with, hey, this is what they have to do, being painted as something that you're not, being misunderstood, being seen as a danger when you're just trying to actually show humility, all of these things. But again, this is why I really wanted to bring you in here today, because it takes so much humility to be able to sit on at different levels, right? And to tolerate your own shame.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be seen as a good white person. Right? I'm not even going to be seen right now. I'm living as a representative of all this pain.
Yeah.
Yeah,
my recovery from it, that a couple of years ago, that example in that group would have laid me out. I would have gone down such a shame spiral and, like, feeling misunderstood. And, like, my recovery time was so much quicker because of this group that I meet with. And the other thing that you're saying that reminds is like, can we see it as, and they talk about this in the train, the vision, they talk about like how it is a gift when someone, like if you're in the dominant culture and someone who's not in the dominant culture can talk to you about how that is, when they can be vulnerable with you and say like, hey, you know, that hurt me when you did that, or whatever. It is a gift and we need to treat it as such. Yeah. And, but again, that's easier said than done when all your stuff comes up. And it reminds me of couples work. When the couple is able to say, to truly be vulnerable and say like, you hurt me in this way, when it's safe enough for them to say that, that's actually a gift, you know, but it's hard.
It's hard to feel that in the moment. Yeah. You just feel, why are you criticizing me?
Exactly.
Yeah, I feel safe enough. There's a chance I might be heard with you.
Yeah.
In other environments, I stay quiet because I don't even think there's hope to be heard. So
absolutely.
Yeah, it definitely
it's hard for couples to see it. Yeah.
But we're talking about a lot of nuanced things. If you could give one takeaway to somebody who's a little bit newer to this work from the stuff you're saying, I want to hear that. And then I want to see if I can shift gears a little bit to how all of this work is feeding into the way you practice therapy.
I guess a couple of takeaways would be like, you can do that. Like almost like you're fair game to participate in this. Like, I think I had a ton in the anti-racist work. Like, I think I just had a ton of insecurities and I still do, self-judgment of like, I'm not radical enough to take an anti-racist course, or I'm not vocal enough, or like, there's like a trope of like a kind of super vocal anti-racist progressive white person. And I'm like, oh, I'm not confident enough to do that. Or I'm not. So like, almost like we sit out, or I'll speak for myself. I sat out on getting more involved in anti-racist work because I thought that I wasn't radical enough or like strong enough or loud enough. And it's like, we can all participate. Like, we can all participate. And that any shame or fear that comes up around this is really normal. You know, I tend to want to get involved in groups where I'm not going to get shamed in this work. And there's a lot of, and I've done it for sure and probably continue to do it, where I'm like shaming other white people for not doing it right, you know, or like, I'm like, oh, like they don't know what they're doing. I know better. So like getting involved in organizations or trainings where that's not the setup, because I think what happens is sometimes we as white people go to these trainings or some training, some groups, and you do get shamed. Yeah. And guess what? That's good. So a couple of organizations I've had really good experience with is Visions. So maybe taking a course with Visions. They have diversity. I always forget it. What is it?
Diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Inclusion. White Awake is another organization. I took a course there that changed my life called Before We Were White. Where it's just like tracking like our own ancestry and what we lost when we got to be deemed as white once we came to the US, and like we lose out on this too in white supremacists. I never thought that I lost out somehow. But that course specifically, Before We Were White. And what was the other question? You said a takeaway. Was that
Let me ask you, it might be a difficult question, but yeah. What's the buy-in? Because what you're talking about, this is hard work. You have to be really humble. You got to sit with your defensiveness. Yeah. You got to sit in your shame. You might get attacked by people. Like,
question.
What is somebody who's sitting in a very white, privileged little bubble going to be like, what are they getting at?
Yeah.
Looking all of this. What is the point?
I guess I just, like, does it ever feel wrong to you? Does it ever feel, do you ever struggle in relationships around this? Do you ever struggle in relationships around race or even sexism? You know, like how many couples, straight couples, heterosexual couples do we see where there's internalized sexism and the partner can't see it? And that's all tied into racism too. Sexism, all of it is tied. So like, I guess the buy-in would be, have you ever felt like something didn't work in a relationship, whether a personal relationship, a work relationship, a friendship where you felt like, oh God, I feel like we can't really talk about things openly because there's racism, because there's sexism, because there's homophobia. Like, I guess that would be the bias. I guess relationships. I was just talking to someone from Visions yesterday, and that's what we were talking about. It's like, I think the buy-in would be, I imagine at some point this has affected a white person's relationship, racism, sexism, whatever it is.
Somewhere. It's not like you can stay in this isolated bubble away from it. It's affecting you. Or if you're in that bubble, you're not getting a chance to be in different situations either. So it's kind of causing you some type of harm that maybe you're not fully aware of, but can you sit with yourself and really ask yourself first, has this affected me? Has this shown up? Is it okay if we shift gears to trying to understand a little bit of the relationship between this work and then therapy? How is this showing up for you in your office? Has this shifted the way you practice?
I think like the short answer is, I mean, my initial reaction is like, I'm not doing enough in my individual practice, in my therapy practice around this. Like, I don't even think I'm being deferential. I think I feel kind of stuck around that. I think that's like, I feel stuck around how to bring anti-racism, anti-oppression work into my therapy. I have a very white clientele, you know, and I'm aware of that. Like, not to say I can't do anti-racist work with white clients. Absolutely, I can. But I guess I just want to say, like, I could be doing more in my therapy practice, I think. And sometimes I don't even know what that is. That said, I do think one perspective shift came from one of our friends who said essentially, like, if you are working predominantly with white clients, like, actually you can't, like, they're the ones who need to hear this the most. They're the ones who need to grapple with this. You can still do, I used to think like anti-racist work, I could only do that with clients of color. Yeah. Right. But I do think one way I'll give myself some credit, like, I think that in my practice, some of the white clients that I see, I think some of them do feel comfortable talking about how they're grappling with racism that might come up in the workplace. Like, if, let's say they're struggling with a coworker of color, and there's been some tension there. I'm very curious about that. I try to make it a place where they can kind of, again, like, experience their shame about that and talk about it in our sessions. I do at times try to bring up, let's say someone is struggling with a sexist coworker, right? Instead of the focus of the therapy just being on, you need to learn how to tolerate that sexism better, mm-hmm. you know, or you need to learn how to respond to that in a way that's like constructive or professional, kind of zooming out and being like, hey, can we just hold on a second? This is so not okay that you're experiencing sexism at work. Not gaslighting a client, essentially, and saying like, this is all about you. Because sometimes people will come and be like, like, this is beyond you, just you. This is beyond just the two of you. We live in a sexist culture. And so, like, almost like putting the outrage first where it's due. Yeah. And then saying, okay. And like, yeah, you want to learn how to manage, you know, like to manage it when you're stressed about it. But so I will say that, like, and that comes from my social work training too, which is always like person and environment, person and systems. But I will say that, like, you know, I have something on my website about how I acknowledge, like, you know, that I'm a white heterosexual cisgender person, and that I continue to like learn about that. I will say that I do wonder if that's helpful to people that are coming to me. Like, you know, I have many same-sex couples that I see, and I've worked with transgender individuals. Like, I do think that making it known, I'm not only comfortable working with individuals are not in the dominant culture, but that I'm continuing to do the work, because that's the key part. Yes. It's like what you said in your podcast interview is that, like, again, I think it's like, there's this like, in the past, I might've been like, well, of course I want to work with people who aren't just like me, like who wouldn't, and just letting them know, like, I'm a good, safe person, yes, in quotation marks. But that's not really going to do them a lot of good if I'm not also educating myself, you know, and making it clear to them, like, this is my expertise, but this isn't, like, because we can end up doing harm. There can be this, like, almost like naive sort of like, I want to see everyone. And like,
yes,
but unless we as the therapists are really taking seriously that, like, our just mere presence as a white therapist might mean that we're not going to get it. Like, yes, like taking that seriously. So maybe in that way, it like feels safer for me to have only white clients. I don't know. I'm just thinking about that.
That's a whole other point. That's a, yeah. Again, like you were saying earlier about something too, of like, it is this deeper and deeper and deeper acknowledgement of how big this thing really is.
Yeah. Is it ethical for me to be a white therapist seeing, you know, someone who is Black or transgender, or if I, like, the onus is on me, yes, to decide, or not to decide. That sounds
so, it's almost creating some safety. But I understand how big this is and how much potential for harm there might be.
Yeah. Here.
So
yeah,
walking, a lot of your journey feels like a shift of trying to be the good white person and the savior and teaching everybody and being and saying to, I'm just sitting deeper and deeper and deeper. This is huge. This is big.
Yeah.
I'm going to be more humble. I'm going to be more careful. I'm going to be more intentional. And that, your, yeah, goal has shifted, and the way you're doing it has shifted, and what you're doing in the therapy practice sounds beautiful too. Like, because you're able to tolerate your own shame around it. If it comes up with your white clients, you're able to tolerate their shame around it and have them sit in that in a different way versus, yeah, maybe somebody who can't sit with their own shame will start pulling their clients out of it too. Right.
Right.
So that sounds big. Huh. And then also understanding the systems. This I see, we talk about this a lot. Oftentimes therapists, because of our training, will want to bring something back to you. And how is this impacting you? And what does this say about your own history or your trauma or your story? And we're missing the bigger pieces in the system that are actually causing harm. And we need, yeah, to validate that. It's gaslighting to, yeah, a client to say, yeah, yeah, that was racist, but why did it really hurt you? Is it because you have daddy issues? Like, what's, no.
It's, yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is real life stuff that's going on. And so you're able to validate that because you're seeing how big it is.
I think, yeah, at times.
That, yeah.
Yeah, no, at times. I'm, yeah, like, I'm sure there's many, many times that I'm missing it, you know, yeah, that I'm missing it. And
so even as I'm saying, oh, you're doing this right, you're doing that, like, you, that, yeah, humility shows up of, I'm in process. Yes. And on your website, you also say, I'm in process. I'm doing, this is a journey. I'm in the midst of it. And I think, yeah, you get to model that for people too, that it's not about being the good white person and then teaching, yeah, everybody else how to be the good white person. It's about modeling that this is a process.
Yeah.
And there's layers. And every time you think you're getting it, there it goes deeper and deeper and deeper.
It's wild. It's really, and I get to opt in and opt out, you know, I get to choose as a white person. I get to opt in and opt out of, you know, when I do that, and I'll often get seen as, I mean, that, yeah, that brings up a feeling in my stomach. Like, I get, like, I'm only going to get praise for this. I'm only going to get praise for doing this work, you know, among people of color. Like, and that's not the case for people of color. And, you know, it's like, I'm only going to get seen. I'm only going to get praise for it. Right. And God, yeah, it's so, yeah, it's so deep.
It is so deep, but I do, yeah, appreciate your humility around this and just the constant wanting to learn and empathize. And that's wonderful. I really appreciate you being here. I hope this did help some people,
yeah,
understand it at a different level. Is there anything you'd like to draw some attention to? You want to, your website, any other projects, mm-hmm, or anything you're part of, any organizations that you talked about already today?
Yeah, I think, yeah, White Awake was the Before We Were White course. And they have lots of different courses. Visions does, you know, the DEI trainings. A podcast series that I listened to that really helped me, especially with being from the North and realizing that Northerners are like, oh, the real racism's in the South, like that sort of thing. That came from a podcast series called Seeing White. I think it's on a program called Seen on Radio or something to that effect. So that it's like a 14 episode podcast series, and it's a white journalist who is just very thorough, and he talks about his own journey, like kind of learning about racism.
Great resource. Yeah, I'll include all of this in the show notes. So that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Join the movement and keep the conversation going at deconstructingtherapy.com and follow us on Instagram at deconstructingtherapy.